Miss Hawkins had seen it all. At least she told people that she had seen it all. She told her few friends about her cabaret life, when she had toured all Europe and was the toast of the richest man in Baghdad. According to herself, she had had lovers of all nationalities, endless proposals of marriage, champagne in every known vessel, not forgetting the slipper. Yet, Miss Hawkins had always had a soft spot for gardening, and in Beirut she had planted roses, hers becoming the first English rose garden in that far-off and spicy land. She told how she watered them at dawn as she returned, accompanied or unaccompanied, from one of her sallies. But time passes, and when Miss Hawkins was 55, she was no longer in gold mesh suits dashing from one capital city to the next. She taught private dancing to supplement her income, and eventually she worked in a municipal garden. As time went by, the gardening was more dear to her than ever her cabaret had been, and not a month without something blooming. At Christmas, was she not proud of her Christmas roses and the Mexican firebush with berries as bright as the decorations on a felt hat? She dressed up when going to see the town councillor about the budget and the plans for the garden, and she dressed in her lamé when one of her ex-dancing pupils invited her to a cocktail party. She dressed up no more than three times a year. But Miss Hawkins herself said that she did not need outings. She was quite content to go into her room at nightfall, heat up the previous day's dinner or else poach eggs, get into bed, cuddle her little dog, look at the television, and drop off to sleep. She retired early so that she could be in her garden while the rest of London was surfacing. Her boast was that she was often up and starting her day while the stars were still in the heavens, and that she moved about like a spirit so as not to disturb the neighbors. It was on such a morning and at such an unearthly hour that Miss Hawkins got a terrible shock concerning her garden. She looked through her window and saw a blue tent, a triangle of utter impertinence inside her terrain. She stormed out, vowing to her little dog and to herself that within minutes it would be a thing of the past. In fact, she found herself closing and reclosing her right fist as if squashing an egg. She was livid. As she came up to it, Miss Hawkins was expecting to find a truant schoolchild, but not at all. There was a grown boy of 20, or perhaps 21, on a mattress. Miss Hawkins was more livid. She noticed at once that he had soft brown hair, white angelic skin, and thick, sensual lips. To make matters worse, he was asleep, and as she wakened him, he threw his hands up and remonstrated like a child. Then he blinked, and as soon as he got his bearings, he smiled at her. Miss Hawkins had to tell him that he was breaking the law. He was the soul of obligingness. He said, "Oh, sorry," and explained how he had come from Kenya, how he had arrived late at night, had not been able to find a hostel, walked around London, and eventually had climbed in over her railings. Miss Hawkins was unable to say the furious things that she had intended to say. Indeed, his good manners had made her almost speechless. Finney asked her what time it was. She could see that he wanted a conversation, but she realized that it was out of keeping with her original mission, and so she turned away. Miss Hawkins was beneath the tree, putting some crocus bulbs in, when the young visitor left. She merely knew it by the clang of the gate. She had left the gate on its latch so that he could go out without having to be conducted by her. And as she patted the earth around the little wan crocuses, she thought, "What a pity! There could not be laws for some and not for others." His smile, his enthusiasm, and his good manners, these had stirred her. And after all, what harm was he doing? Yet, thought Miss Hawkins, bylaws are bylaws. And she hit the ground with her trowel. That evening, as she crossed the road to her house, she stood under the lamplight and looked up the street to where there was the red neon glow from the public house. She had a very definite and foolish longing to be going into the lounge bar with a young escort and demurring as to whether to have a gin and tonic or a gin and pink. Presently, she found that she had slapped herself. The rule was never to go into public houses since it was vulgar, and never to drink since it was the road that led to ruin. She ran into her house. The next morning, as she stepped out in her warm trouser suit with a brown muffler around her neck, there he was. He was actually waiting for her by the garden gate, and he was as solemn as a fledgling altar boy. He said that he had come to apologize, that after 24 hours in England, he was a little more cognizant of rules and regulations, and that he had come to ask her to forgive him. She said certainly. She said he could come in if he wished, and then she walked towards the tool shed. He followed and helped her out with the implements. Miss Hawkins instructed him what to do. He was to dig a patch into which she would put her summer blooms. She told him the Latin name of all these flowers, their appearance and their characteristics. He was amazed at the way she could rattle off all these items while digging or pruning, or even overseeing what he was doing. And so it went on. He would work for an hour or so and then tootle off, and once when it was very cold and they had to fetch watering cans of warm water to thaw out a flower bed, she weakened and offered him a coffee. The result was that he arrived the next day with biscuits. He said that he had been given a present of 2 tickets for the theatre, and was she by the merest, tiniest chance free, and would she be so kind as to come with him? Miss Hawkins hesitated, but of course her heart had yielded. She frowned and said, could he not ask someone younger, someone in his own age group, to which he said no, no. Dash it, she thought. Theatre was theatre, and her very, very first calling, and without a doubt, she would go. The play was to be Othello. Oh, how she loved it, understood it, and was above it all. The jealous Moor, the telltale handkerchief, confessions, counter-confessions, the poor, sweet, wretched, wronged Desdemona. Miss Hawkins raised her hands, acted for a moment, and said, that poor dear girl caught in a jealous web. At the supper afterwards, they discussed jealousy, and Miss Hawkins was able to assure him that she no longer suffered from that ghastly complaint, but he did. He was a positive pickle of jealousy. Teach me not to be, he said. He almost touched her, and she drew back, alarmed and offended, apparently by this indiscretion. He retrieved things by offering to pick up her plastic lighter and light her cigarette. Miss Hawkins was enjoying herself. She ate a lot, smoked a lot, drank a lot, but at no time did she lose her composure. In fact, she was mirth personified, and after he had dropped her at her front door, she sauntered down the steps to her basement, then waved her beaded purse at him, and said, as English workmen say, mind how you go. Naturally, things took a turn for the better. She and he now had a topic to discuss, and it was theatre. It, too, was his ambition, and he had come to England to study it. So, in between pruning or digging or manuring, Miss Hawkins was giving her sage opinion of things, endeavouring to improve his projection by making him say certain key sentences. She even made him sing. It was on St. Valentine's Day that he told Miss Hawkins that he had to quit the flat he was lodging in. Miss Hawkins then said that he must move in with her, and he was aghast with relief. He asked her, did she mean it? He stressed what a quiet lodger he would be and how it would only be a matter of weeks until he found another place. Stay as long as you like, Miss Hawkins said. And all through this encounter she was brusque in order not to let things slide into a bath of sentiment. But inside, Miss Hawkins was rippling. That evening she went to a supermarket so as to stock up with things. She would have a nice display of forsythia in the tall china jug. She would have the table laid for supper. And she would announce that since it was his first night, they would have a bit of a celebration. She ferreted through her 6 cookery books, those were from her married days, before deciding on the recipe she wanted. Naturally, she would not want it to be miserly. It simply must, have bouquet. She had decided on baked eggs with a sprinkling of cheese and kidneys cooked in red wine with button mushrooms. He had suggested that he would bring some wine, and she had already got out the cut glasses, washed them and shone them, so that their little wedges were a sea of instant and changeable rainbow. She sat at the little round supper table and passed things politely. She was practicing. Miss Hawkins had not passed an entree dish for years, and she decided to use the linen napkins and got out two of her mother's bone napkin holders. They smelt of vanilla. "Nice man coming," she would tell her little dog, as she tripped about tidying her drawers, dusting her dressing table, and debating the most subtle position for a photograph of herself, one from the cabaret days. At length, and without fully undressing, Miss Hawkins flopped onto her bed, with her little dog beside her. Miss Hawkins had such dratted nightmares, stupid rigmaroles in which she was being incarcerated, or ones in which she had to carry furniture, or worse, one in which she had to cater on nothing for a marquee of people. Indeed, an unsavory one, in which a cowpat became confused with a fried egg. Oh, was she vexed! Oh, was she vexed! Her hands trembled, and she was definitely on edge. In the garden the following morning, Miss Hawkins kept looking towards her own door, lest he arrive early, lest she miss him. Her heart was in a dither. By lunchtime she was quite distraught, and by 3 o'clock she was pacing her floor. The real trouble had been admitted. She was afraid. Afraid of the obvious. She might become attached. She might fall a fraction in love. She might cross the room, or, shyly, he might cross the room, and a wonderful surprise embrace might ensue, and then... It was that then that horrified her. She shuddered. She let out an involuntary... No. She could not bear to see him leave, even leave amicably. She dreaded suitcases, packing, goodbyes, stoicism, chin up, her empty, beseeching hand, and the whole unbearable lodestone of it. She could not have him there. She could not. Quickly, she penned the note, then she got her coat, her handbag, and her little dog in its basket, and she flounced out. The note was on the top step, under a milk bottle. It was addressed to him. The message was curt. It said, "You must never, ever, under any circumstances, come here again." Miss Hawkins took a taxi to Victoria, and thence a train to Brighton. She had an invalid friend there to whom she owed a visit. In the train, as she looked out at the sooty suburbs, Miss Hawkins was willing to concede that she had done a very stupid thing indeed, but that it had to be admitted that it was not the most stupid thing she could have done. The most stupid thing would have been to welcome him in.